Introduction of the Edison Electric Light, abridged from Edison, His Life and Inventions by Frank Lewis Dyer and Thomas Comerford Martin. It was not a fact at any time that the public was opposed to the idea of electric light. On the contrary, the conditions for its acceptance had been ripening fast, yet the very vogue of the electric arc light made harder the arrival of the incandescent. As a new illuminant for the streets, the arc had become familiar, either as a direct substitute for the low gas lamps along the sidewalk curb, or as a novel form of moonlight raised in groups at the top of lofty towers, often 150 feet high. Some of these lights were already in use for large indoor spaces, although the size of the unit, the deadly pressure of the current, and the sputtering sparks from the carbons made them highly objectionable for such purposes. When the great National Electric Light Association was formed in 1885, its organizers were the captains of arc lighting, and not a single Edison company or licensee could be found in its ranks or dared to solicit membership. The Edison Company, soon numbering about 300, formed their own association, still maintained as a separate and useful body, and the lines were tensely drawn in a way that made it none too easy for the Edison service to advance or for an impartial man to remain friendly with both sides. But the growing popularity of incandescent lighting, the flexibility and safety of the system, the ease with which other electric devices for heat, power, etc. could be put indiscriminately on the same circuits with the lamps, in due course rendered the old attitude of opposition obviously foolish and untenable. The United States Census Office statistics of 1902 showed that the income from incandescent lighting by central stations had by that time become over 52% of the total, while that from arc lighting was less than 29%, and electric power service, due to the ease with which motors could be introduced on incandescent circuits, brought in 15% more. Hence, 20 years after the first Edison stations were established, the methods they involved could be fairly credited with no less than 67% of all central station income in the country, and the proportion has grown since then. The other strong opposition to the incandescent light came from the gas industry. There also the most bitter feeling was shown. The gas manager did not like the arc light, but it interfered only with his street service, which was not his largest source of income by any means. What did arouse his ire and indignation was to find this new opponent, the little incandescent lamp, pushing boldly into the field of interior lighting, claiming it on a great variety of grounds of superiority and calmly ignoring the question of price because it was so much better. Newspaper records and the pages of the technical papers of the day show to what an extent prejudice and passion were stirred up, and the astounding degree to which the opposition to the new light was carried. A retrospective study shows that had the men in control of the American gas lighting art in 1880 been sufficiently far-sighted, and had they taken a broader view of the situation, they might easily have remained dominant in the whole field of artificial lighting by securing the ownership of the patents and devices of the new industry. Apparently not a single step of that kind was undertaken, nor probably was there a gas manager who would have agreed with Edison in the opinion written down by him at the time in his little notebook number 184, that gas properties were having conferred on them an enhanced earning capacity. It was doubtless fortunate and providential for the electric lighting art that in its state of immature development, it did not fall into the hands of men who were opposed to its growth and would not have sought its technical perfection. It was allowed to carve out its own career and thus escape the fate that is supposed to have attended other great inventions of being bought up merely for the purpose of suppression. There's a vague popular notion that this happens to the public loss, But the truth is, no discovery of any real value is ever entirely lost. So much for the early opposition, of which there was plenty. But it may be questioned whether inertia is not equally to be dreaded with its active ill will. Nothing is more difficult in the world than to get a good many hundreds of thousands or millions of people to do something they've never done before. A very great difficulty in the introduction of his lamp and lighting system by Edison lay in the absolute ignorance of the public at large, not only as to its merits, but as to the very appearance of the light. Several few thousand people had gone to Menlo Park and there had seen the lamps in operation at the laboratory or on the hillsides, but they were an insignificant proportion of the inhabitants of the United States. Another serious difficulty confronting Edison and his associates was that nowhere in the world were there to be purchased any of the appliances necessary for the use of the lighting system. Edison had resolved from the very first that the initial central station embodying his various ideas should be installed in New York City, where he would superintend the installation personally, and then watch the operation. Plans to that end were now rapidly maturing, but there would be needed, among many other things, any one of them new and novel, dynamos, switchboards, regulators, pressure and current indicators, fixtures in great variety, incandescent lamps, meters, sockets, small switches, underground conductors, junction boxes, service boxes, manhole boxes, connectors, and even specially made wire. Now, not one of these miscellaneous things was in existence. Not an outsider was sufficiently informed about such devices to make them on order, except perhaps the special wire. Edison therefore started first of all a lamp factory in one of the buildings at Menlo Park, equipped it with novel machinery and apparatus, and began to instruct men, boys, and girls, as they could be enlisted in the absolutely new art, putting Mr. Upton in charge. With regard to the conditions attendant upon the manufacture of lamps, Edison says, "When we first started the electric light, we had to have a factory for manufacturing lamps. As the Edison Light Company did not seem disposed to go into manufacturing, we started a small lamp factory at Menlo Park with what money I could raise from my other inventions and royalties and some assistance. The lamps at that time were costing about $1.25 each to make. So I said to the company, 'If you will give me a contract during the life of the patents, I will make all the lamps required by the company and deliver them for 40 cents. The company jumped at the chance of this offer, and a contract was drawn up. We then bought at a receiver sale at Harrison, New Jersey, a very large brick factory building which had been used as an oilcloth works. We got it at a great bargain and only paid a small sum down and the balance on mortgage. We moved the lamp works from Menlo Park to Harrison. The first year the lamps cost about $1.10 each. We sold them for 40 cents, but there were only about 20 or 30,000 of them. The next year they cost us about 70 cents, and we sold them for 40. There were a good many, and we lost more money the second year than the first. The third year I succeeded in getting up machinery and in changing the processes until it got down so that they cost somewhere around 50 cents. I still sold them at 40 cents and lost more money that year than any other because the sales were increasing rapidly. The fourth year I got it down to 37 cents, and I made all the money up in 1 year that I had lost previously. I finally got it down to 22 cents and sold them for 40 cents, and they were made by the million. Whereupon the Wall Street people thought it was a very lucrative business, so they concluded they would like to have it and bought us out. One of the incidents which caused a great cheapening was that when we started, one of the important processes had to be done by experts. This was the sealing of the part carrying the filament into the globe, which was a rather delicate operation in those days, and required several months of training before one could seal in a fair number of parts in a day. When we got to the point where we employed 80 of these experts, they formed a union, and knowing it was impossible to manufacture lamps without them, they became very insolent. One instance was that the son of one of these experts was employed in the office, and when he was told to do anything, would not do it, or would give an insolent reply. He was discharged, whereupon the union notified us unless the boy was taken back, the whole body would go out. It got so bad that the manager came to me and said he could not stand it any longer. Something had got to be done. They were not only more surly, they were diminishing the output, and it became impossible to manage the works. He got me enthused on the subject, so I started in to see if it were not possible to do that operation by machinery. After feeling around for some days, I got a clue how to do it. I then put men on it I could trust and made the preliminary machinery. That seemed to work pretty well. I then made another machine which did the work nicely. I then made a third machine and would bring in yard men, ordinary laborers, etc. And when I could get these men to put the parts together as well as the trained experts in an hour, I considered the machine complete. I then went secretly to work and made 30 of the machines. Up in the top loft of the factory, we stored those machines, and at night we put up the benches and got everything all ready. Then we discharged the office boy. Then the union went out. It's been out ever since. When we formed the works at Harrison, we divided the interest into 100 shares or parts at $100 par. One of the boys was hard up after a time and sold 2 shares to Bob Cutting. Up to that time, we had never paid anything, but we got around to the point where the board declared a dividend every Saturday night. We had never declared a dividend when Cutting bought his shares, and after getting his dividends for 3 weeks in succession, he called up on the telephone and wanted to know what kind of concern this was that paid a weekly dividend. The work sold for $1,085,000. Incidentally, it may be noted as illustrative of the problems brought to Edison that while he had the factory at Harrison, an importer in the Chinese trade went to him and wanted a dynamo to be run by hand power. The importer explained that in China, human labor was cheaper than steam power. Edison devised a machine to answer the purpose and put long spokes on it, fitted it up, and shipped it to China. He's not, however, heard of it since. For making the dynamos, Edison secured, as noted in the preceding chapter, the Roach Iron Works in New York, and this was also equipped. A building was rented on Washington Street where machinery and tools were put in specially designed for making the underground tube conductors and their various paraphernalia, and the faithful John Crucy was given charge of that branch of production. To Sigmund Bergman, who'd worked previously with Edison on telephone apparatus and the phonographs, and was already making Edison's specialties in a small way in a loft on Worcester Street, New York, was assigned the task of constructing sockets, fixtures, meters, safety fuses, and numerous other devices. Thus, broadly, the manufacturing end of the problem of introduction was cared for. In the early parts of 1881, the Edison Electric Light Company leased the old Bishop Mansion at 65 Fifth Avenue, close to 14th Street, for its headquarters and showrooms. This was one of the finest homes in the city of that period, and its acquisition was a sign of the surrender of the famous residential avenue to commerce. The company needed not only offices, but even more such an interior as would display to advantage the new lights in everyday use, and this house, with its liberal lines, spacious halls, lofty ceilings, wide parlors, and graceful winding stairway, was ideal for the purpose. In fact, in undergoing this violent change, it did not cease to be a home in the real sense, for to this day many an Edison veteran's pulse is quickened by some chance reference to 65, where through many years the work of development by a loyal and devoted band of workers was centered. Here Edison and a few of his assistants from Menlo Park installed immediately in the basement a small generating plant, at first with a gas engine, which was not successful, and then with a Hampson high-speed engine and boiler, constituting a complete isolated plant. The building was wired from top to bottom and equipped with all the appliances of the art. The experience with little gas engines was rather startling. At an early period, at 65, we decided, says Edison, to light it up with the Edison system and put a gas engine in the cellar using city gas. One day it was not going very well, and I went down to the man in charge and got exploring around. Finally, I opened the pedestal, a storehouse for tools, etc. We had an open lamp, and when we opened the pedestal, it blew the doors off and blew out the windows and knocked me down and the other man. For the next 4 or 5 years, 65 was a veritable beehive, day and night. The routine was very much the same as that at the laboratory in its utter neglect of the clock. The evenings were not only devoted to the continuance of regular business, but the house was thrown open to the public until late at night, never closing before 10 o'clock, so as to give everybody who wished an opportunity to see that great novelty of the time, the incandescent light, whose fame had meanwhile been spreading all over the globe. The first year, 1881, was naturally that which witnessed the greatest rush of visitors, and the building hardly ever closed its doors till midnight. During the day, business was carried on under great stress, and Mr. Insull has described how Edison was to be found there trying to lead the life of a man of affairs in the conventional garb of polite society, instead of pursuing inventions and researches in his laboratory. But the disagreeable ordeal could not be dodged. After the experience, Edison could never again be tempted to quit his laboratory and work for any length of time. But in this instance, there were some advantages attached to the sacrifice. For the crowds of lion hunters and people seeking business arrangements would only have gone out to Menlo Park, while, on the other hand, the great plans for lighting New York demanded very close personal attention on the spot. As it was, not only Edison, but all the company directors, officers, and employees were kept busy exhibiting and explaining the light. To the public of that day, when the highest known form of house illuminant was gas, the incandescent lamp, with its ability to burn in any position, its lack of heat so that you could put your hand on the brilliant glass globe, the absence of any vibrating effect on the atmosphere, the obvious safety from fire, the curious fact that you needed no matches to light it, and that it was under absolute control from a distance. These and many other features came as a distinct revelation and marvel. While promising so much additional comfort, convenience, and beauty in the home, that inspection was almost invariably followed by a request for installation. The camaraderie that existed at this time was very democratic, for all were workers in a common cause. All were enthusiastic believers in the doctrine they proclaimed, and hoped to profit by the opening up of the new art. Often at night, in the small hours, all would adjourn for refreshments to a famous resort nearby to discuss the events of today and tomorrow, full of incident and excitement. The easy relationship of the time is neatly sketched by Edison in a humorous complaint as to his inability to keep his own cigars. When at 65, I used to have in my desk a box of cigars. I would go to the box 4 or 5 times to get a cigar, but after it got circulated about the building, everybody would come to get my cigars, so that the box would only last about a day and a half. I was telling a gentleman one day that I could not keep a cigar. Even if I locked them up in my desk, they would break it open. He suggested to me that he had a friend on 8th Avenue who made a superior grade of cigars, and who would show them a trick. He said he would get some of them made up with hair and old paper, and I would put them in without a word and see the result. I thought no more of the matter. He came in 2 or 3 months after and said, "How did that cigar business work?" I didn't remember anything about it. On coming to investigate, it appeared that the box of cigars had been delivered, and I had put them in my desk, and I had smoked them all. I was too busy on other things to notice. We are indebted to Mr. Insull for a graphic sketch of Edison at this period and of the conditions under which work was done and progress was made. I do not think I had any understanding with Edison when I first went with him as to my duties. I did whatever he told me and looked after all kinds of affairs, from buying his clothes to financing his business. I used to open the correspondence and answer it all, sometimes signing Edison's name with my initial, and sometimes signing my own name. If the latter course was pursued and I was addressing a stranger, I would sign as Edison's private secretary. I held his power of attorney and signed his checks. It was seldom that Edison signed a letter or check at this time. If he wanted personally to send a communication to anybody, if it was one of his close associates, it would probably be a pencil memorandum signed Edison. I was a shorthand writer, but seldom took down from Edison's dictation unless it was on some technical subject that I did not understand. I would go over the correspondence with Edison, sometimes making a marginal note in shorthand, and sometimes Edison would make his own notes on letters, and I would be expected to clean up the correspondence with Edison's laconic comments as a guide as to the character of answer to make. It was a very common thing for Edison to write the words yes or no, and this would be all I had on which to base my answer. Edison marginalized documents extensively. He had a wonderful ability in pointing out the weak points of an agreement or a balance sheet, all the while protesting he was no lawyer or accountant, and his views were expressed in very few words, but in a characteristic and emphatic manner. The first few months I was with Edison, he spent most of his time in the office at 65 Fifth Avenue. Then there was a great deal of trouble with the life of the lamps there, and he disappeared from the office and spent his time largely at Menlo Park. At another time, there was a great deal of trouble with some of the details of construction of the dynamos, and Edison spent a lot of time at Gurk Street, which had been rapidly equipped with the idea of turning out bipolar dynamo electric machines direct connected to the engine, the first of which went to Paris and London, while the next were installed in the old Pearl Street station of the Edison Electric Illuminating Company of New York, just south of Fulton Street, on the west side of the street. Edison devoted a great deal of his time to the engineering work in connection with the laying out of the first incandescent electric lighting system in New York. Apparently at that time, between the end of 1881 and spring of 1882, the most serious work was the manufacture and installation of underground conductors in this territory. These conductors were manufactured by the Edison Tube Company, which Edison controlled in a shop at 65 Washington Street run by John Crucy. Half-round copper conductors were used, kept in place relative to one another in the tube, first of all by a heavy piece of cardboard, and later on by a rope, and then put in a 20-foot iron pipe, and a combination of asphaltum and linseed oil was forced into the pipe for the insulation. I remember as a coincidence that the building was only 20 feet wide. These lengths of conductors were 20 feet 6 inches long, as the half-round coppers extended 3 inches beyond the drag ends of the lengths of pipe, and in one of the operations we used to take the length of tubing out of the window in order to turn it around. I was elected secretary of the Electric Tube Company and was expected to look after its finance, and it was in this position that my long intimacy with John Crucy started. At this juncture, a large part of the correspondence referred very naturally to electric lighting, embodying requests for all kinds of information, catalogs, prices, terms, etc., and all these letters were turned over to the lighting company by Edison for attention. The company was soon swamped with propositions for sale of territorial rights and with other negotiations, and some of these were accompanied by the offer of very large sums of money. It was the beginning of the electric light furor, which soon rose to sensational heights. Had the company accepted the cash offers from various localities, it could have gathered in several millions of dollars at once into its treasury. But this was not at all in accord with Mr. Edison's idea, which was to prove by actual experience the commercial value of the system, and then to license central station companies in large cities and towns, the parent company taking a percentage of their capital for the license under the Edison patents, and contracting also for the supply of apparatus, lamps, etc. This left the remainder of the country open for the cash sale of plants wherever requested. His counsels prevailed, and the wisdom of the policy adopted was seen in the swift establishment of the Edison companies in centers of population, both great and small, whose business has ever been a constant and growing source of the income of the parent manufacturing interests. From first to last, Edison has been an exponent and advocate of the central station idea of distribution now so familiar to the public mind, but still very far from being carried out to its logical conclusion. In this instant, demand for isolated plants for lighting factories, mills, mines, hotels, etc. began to pour in, and something had to be done with them. This was a class of plant which the inquirers desired to purchase outright and operate themselves, usually because of the remoteness from any possible source of general supply of current. It had not been Edison's intention to cater to this class of customers until his broad central station plan had been worked out, and he's always discouraged the isolated plant within the limits of urban circuits. But this demand was so insistent it could not be denied, and it was deemed desirable to comply with it at once, especially as it was seen that the steady call for supplies and renewals would benefit the new Edison manufacturing plants. After a very short trial, it was found necessary to create a separate organization for this branch of the industry, leaving the Edison Electric Light Company to continue under the original plan of operation as a parent, patent-holding, and licensing company. Accordingly, a new and distinct corporation was formed called the Edison Company for Isolated Lighting, to which was issued a special license to sell and operate plants of a self-contained character. As a matter of fact, such work began in advance of almost every other kind. A small plant using paper carbon filament lamps was furnished by Edison at the earnest solicitation of Mr. Henry Villard of the steamship Columbia in 1879, and it is amusing to note that Mr. Upton carried the lamps himself to the ship, very tenderly and jealously, like fresh eggs in a market garden basket. The installation was most successful. Another pioneer plant that was equipped and started in January 1881 for Hines & Ketchum, a New York firm of lithographers and color printers who'd previously been able to work only by day owing to the difficulties in color printing by artificial light. A year later, they said it's the best substitute for daylight we've ever known and almost as cheap. Mr. Edison himself describes various instances in which the demand for isolated plants had to be met. One night at 65, he says, James Gordon Bennett came in. We were very anxious to get into a printing establishment. I had caused a printer's composing case to be set up with the idea that if we could get editors and publishers in to see it, we should show them the advantage of the electric light. So ultimately Mr. Bennett came, and after seeing the whole operation of everything, he ordered Mr. Howland, general manager of the Herald, to light the newspaper offices up at once with electricity. The art was, however, very crude and raw, and as there were no artisans in existence as mechanics or electricians who had any knowledge of the practice, there was inconceivable difficulty in getting such isolated plants installed, as well as wiring the buildings in the district to be covered by the first central station in New York. A night school was therefore founded at Fifth Avenue and was put in charge of Mr. E. H. Johnson, fresh from his successes in England. The most available men for the purpose were, of course, those who had been accustomed to wiring for the simpler electrical systems then in vogue, telephones, district messenger calls, burglar alarms, house annunciators, etc., and a number of these wiremen were engaged and instructed patiently in the rudiments of the new art by means of a blackboard and oral lessons. Students from the technical schools and colleges were also eager recruits, for here was something that promised a career and one that was especially alluring to youth because of its novelty. These beginners were also instructed in general engineering problems under the guidance of Mr. C.L. Clark, who was brought in from Menlo Park Laboratory to assume charge of engineering parts of the company's affairs. A very novel literary feature of the work was the issuance of a bulletin devoted entirely to the Edison lighting propaganda. Nowadays, the house organ, as it's called, has become a very hackneyed feature of industrial development, confusing in its variety and volume, and a somewhat doubtful adjunct to a highly perfected, widely circulated periodical technical press. But at that time, 1882, the Bulletin of the Edison Electric Light Company, published in ordinary 12-month form, was distinctly new in advertising and possibly unique, as it is difficult to find anything that compared with it. The first item in the first bulletin dealt with the fire question, and all through the successive issues runs a series of significant items on the same subject. Many of them are aimed at gas, and there are several grim summaries of death and fires due to gas leaks or explosions. A tendency existed at the time to assume that electricity was altogether safe, while its opponents, predicating their attacks on arc lighting casualties, insisted it was most dangerous. Edison's problem in educating the public was rather difficult, for while his low-pressure direct current system has always been absolutely without danger to life, there has also been the undeniable fact that escaping electricity might cause a fire, just as a leaky water pipe can flood a house. The important question had arisen, therefore, of satisfying the fire underwriters as to the safety of the system. He had foreseen there would be an absolute necessity for special devices to prevent fires from occurring by reason of any excess of current flowing in any circuit, and several of his earliest detail lighting inventions deal with the subject. The insurance underwriters of New York and other parts of the country gave a great deal of time and study to the question through their most expert representatives, with the aid of Edison and his associates, other electric light companies cooperating, and the knowledge thus gained were embodied in insurance rules to govern wiring for electric lights, formulated during the latter part of 1881, adopted by the New York Board of Fire Underwriters January 12, 1882, and subsequently endorsed by other boards in the various insurance districts. Success of those early years was indeed only achieved by following up with Chinese exactness the minute and intimate methods insisted upon by Edison as to the use of the apparatus and devices employed. For many years, Kirk Street played an important part in Edison's affairs, being the center of all his manufacture of heavy machinery. But it was not in a desirable neighborhood, and owing to the rapid growth of the business, soon became disadvantageous for other reasons. Edison tells of his frequent visits to the shops at night with the escort of Jim Russell, a well-known detective who knew all the denizens of the place. "We used to go out at night to a little low place, an all-night house, 8 feet wide and 22 feet long, where we got a lunch at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. It was the toughest kind of restaurant ever seen. For the clam chowder, they used the same 4 clams during the whole season, and the average number of flies per pie was 7. This was by actual count. As to the shops and the locality, the street was lined with rather old buildings and poor tenements. We had not much frontage. As our business increased enormously, our quarters became too small, so we saw the district Tammany leader and asked him if we could not store castings and other things on the sidewalk. He gave us permission, told us to go ahead, and he would see it was all right. The only thing he required for this was that when a man was sent with a note from him asking us to give him a job, he was to be put on. We had a hand laborer foreman, Big Jim, a very powerful Irishman, who could lift above half a ton. When one of the Tammany aspirants appeared, he was told to go right to work at $1.50 per day. The next day he was told off to lift a certain piece, and if the man could not lift it, he was discharged. That made the Tammany man all safe. Jim could pick the piece up easily. The other man could not, so we let him out. Finally, the Tammany leader called a halt, as we were running big engine lathes out on the sidewalk, and he was afraid we were carrying it a little too far. The lathes were worked right out in the street and belted through the windows of the shop. At last it became necessary to move from Girk Street, and Mr. Edison gives a very interesting account of the incidents in connection with the transfer of the plant to Schenectady, New York. After our works at Girk Street got too small, we had labor troubles also. It seems I had a rather socialistic strain in me, and I raised the pay of the workmen 25 cents an hour above the prevailing rate of wages, whereupon Ho and Company, our near neighbors, complained at our doing this. I said I thought it was all right. But the men, having got a little more wages, thought they would try coercion and get a little more, as we were considered soft marks. Whereupon they struck at a time that was critical. However, we were short of money for payrolls, and we concluded it might not be so bad after all, as it would give us a couple of weeks to catch up. So when the men went out, they appointed a committee to meet us. But for 2 weeks they could not find us, so they became somewhat more anxious than we were. Finally, they said they would like to go back. We said all right, and back they went. It was quite a novelty to the men not being able to find us when they wanted to, and they didn't relish it at all. What with these troubles and the lack of room, we decided to find a factory elsewhere and decided to try the locomotive works up at Schenectady. It seems that the people there had a falling out among themselves, and one of the directors had started opposition works, but before he had completed all the buildings and put in machinery, some compromise was made and the works were for sale. We bought them very reasonably and moved everything there. These works were owned by me and my assistants until sold to the Edison General Electric Company. At one time we employed several thousand men, and since then the works have been greatly expanded. At these new works our orders were far in excess of our capital to handle the business, and both Mr. Insull and I were afraid we might get into trouble for lack of money. Mr. Insull was then my business manager running the whole thing, and therefore, when Mr. Henry Villard and his syndicate offered to buy us out, we concluded it was better to be sure than to be sorry, so we sold out for a large sum. Villard was a very aggressive man with big ideas, but I could never quite understand him. He had no sense of humor. The formation of the Edison General Electric Company involved the consolidation of the immediate Edison manufacturing interest in electric light and power with a capitalization of $12 million, now a relatively modest sum, but in those days the amount was large and the combination caused a great deal of newspaper comment as to such a coinage of brain power. The next step came with the creation of the great General Electric Company of today, a combination of the Edison, Thomson-Houston, and Brush lighting interests in manufacture.